Welcome to Artrageous, a weekly podcast about the truly outrageous stories in the art and design world. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Artrageous. Last week, I talked about how Andy Warhol's Prince series has found itself in the center of a lawsuit that's made it all the way to the Supreme Court. And while researching that episode, I learned and then kind of remembered the story about how Andy Warhol was almost assassinated in 1968 by a fellow artist. Now, there's really no surprise ending for this story because the attempted murder was unsuccessful, but the story behind the incident is rather interesting. So to piggyback off of last week's episode, I figured we could just follow up with this story. Now, I am going to put a warning here that some of the details I found for this episode might be a little more intense and graphic than you're used to hearing on Artrageous. I haven't told a story of a violent crime here on the show yet, so this is a first, but just know that this story may get a little intense in places, so please bear with me as I tell you about this very intriguing story. Since we talked about Andy Warhol last week, I don't want to bore any weekly listeners with too much of the same information, but if you're tuning in for the first time or haven't listened to last week's episode yet, I'll do a slight recap, but with a little bit different biographical information. Trying to keep things fresh as much as possible, you know? Andy Warhol is a famous artist who was born in 1928 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but fun fact, his real name isn't Andy Warhol. It's Andrew Warhola Jr. His father immigrated from Austria-Hungary to the United States in 1914, and his mother followed in 1921 after his grandparents passed away. As a kid, Warhol had a disease called Sydenham's chorea, also known as St. Vitus's dance, which is a nervous system disease causing involuntary movements of extremities. This caused him to be confined to his bed, where he became interested in drawing and listening to the radio and collecting pictures of movie stars. While this is a really unfortunate way for a young child to have to spend their time, when looking back on it, Warhol described it as a very important period in his life because it helped him develop his personality and skill sets. Knowing that, I can now definitely see how that experience would lead him to study commercial art at Carnegie Mellon University in the 1940s. I would say that Warhol's early career was mostly defined by commercial and advertising art, and it started with shoes. His first ever commission was from Glamour magazine in the late 40s. He had this really intriguing technique where he applied ink to the surface and then blotted it away while it was still wet. By using tracing paper, he was able to repeat the images he drew while also creating unlimited variations of his drawings. I don't know if he had a full-on fascination with shoes, but he did end up working for a designer shoe manufacturer in the 1950s and really got into being an advertisement illustrator. While he had varying degrees of success with his ink shoe drawings in the 50s, if we fast forward to the 1960s, that's when he got into silkscreen printing. I talked about that process a little bit more in depth in the last episode, but silkscreen printing is where you have a series of screens that are kind of like stencils, and you can use them to apply ink to whatever surface you're printing on. Like stencils, you can use them over and over again, and you can do a lot of cool color variations on the same image. This technique is how he created his famous Marilyn Monroe images and many, many others. One of the biggest themes in Warhol's work was the emphasis on consumerism. You would think something as simple as a soup can would have people scratching their heads and asking why, since that wasn't traditionally what people saw in galleries and exhibitions, which is exactly why art critics in the early 60s were so harsh on his work and his open acceptance of consumer market culture. And yet his pieces were so incredibly popular because of how they elevated that common thing to something of interest and emphasized the process of mass production by objectifying a subject to the extreme. And I promise all of this info is leading somewhere, kind of like setting the scene is what I guess you would call it. In the early 60s, Warhol was really breaking into the art scene, and it allowed him to feel confident enough to rent his first studio space in New York City. Even though his first studio wasn't much to talk about, it was where he created his Elvis series and helped his future success, which led him to moving to East 47th Street in New York, which would later turn into what was called The Factory. This studio would become an incredibly popular gathering place for a wide range of artists, writers, musicians, and underground celebrities. Why? Because it was basically a huge party scene, which I would guess was filled with lots of alcohol and drug-infused creativity flying amok. What's weird is I would never think of a studio space as a party space. Then again, considering he originally rented the studio space because of the mess his work was causing at home, I guess a little party mess might not be that bad considering the already present studio mess. Anyway, in 1963, Warhol was invited to a haircutting party, which I'm going to assume is exactly what it sounds like, but I could be wrong. Anyway, Warhol went to a party at another artist's apartment. I don't know if you're familiar with a photographer and filmmaker named Billy Name, but it was his apartment and it was decorated with tinfoil and silver paint. I looked up some pictures, and if what I found is correct, then we're talking about floor-to-ceiling tinfoil-covered walls, which is kind of trippy. But apparently, Andy Warhol had a great time because he decided he wanted to do something like that to decorate his studio. Billy Name came over and covered Andy Warhol's entire studio in silver, even down to the elevator, which is why the first factory location was often called the Silver Factory. Unfortunately, all good things come to an end, and the Silvery Factory's building was slated for demolition, and he had to find another place. But it wasn't all fun and games. Being a prominent artist making a living off of his work, Andy Warhol was working day and night on his paintings, but he also used silk screens so that he could mass-produce images the same way that corporations mass-produce goods. I think the factory truly lived up to its name because it became almost like an assembly line for all of the silk screens and work that Andy Warhol was producing. I guess if the subject and commentary of your work is centered around commercialism, consumerism, and mass production, then why not make your studio embody it too? To increase his production even more, Warhol brought in all kinds of people to help him. We're talking freethinkers, musicians, adult film performers, drag queens, socialites, and even drug addicts. The Warhol superstars, as they were called, became art workers who helped him create his paintings, they starred in his films, and I would even go so far as to say they helped create the atmosphere for which the factory became absolutely legendary for. Now, I mentioned assassination and murder in this episode title, which leads us to the logical conclusion that there was another person involved in this story. See, I promise I haven't forgotten about the true story here. Everything up until now, including the factory, is what led to Andy Warhol meeting Valerie Solanas. Valerie Solanas was born in 1936 in New Jersey. She didn't have the best upbringing, and it's reported that she was unfortunately sexually abused as a child and was also a child of divorce. She really didn't like her stepfather and started to rebel against her mother. Her grandfather was a violent alcoholic who often beat her. And she also had a son at the age of 15 who was fathered by a married sailor, and that baby was put up for adoption. It really pains me to hear stories like this because it's just so unfortunate that something like that could ever happen to a kid. I know that psychologically, this type of upbringing could account for her truant behavior and how she would actually sell insults to children to use on one another for a dime each, or for why she beat up other kids. But it's just a horrible childhood that I would never wish upon anyone. Fortunately, though, she was able to make the best of it. She graduated from high school and went on to earn a degree in psychology, where she was also in the Honor Society. While she was in college, she also hosted a call-in radio show where she gave advice on how to combat men. She then went on to the University of Minnesota's Graduate School of Psychology, where she worked in the Animal Research Laboratory before she dropped out and moved so that she could attend Berkeley for a few courses. At this point in her story, it's the mid-1960s, and Solanas had moved to New York City, where she supported herself through begging and prostitution. The good news is that she continued with her creative outlets and in 1965 wrote an autobiographical short story and a stage play called Up Your Ass about a young prostitute. She also wrote something called the Scum Manifesto. And I don't know if you've ever heard of the Scum Manifesto before, but it stands for Society for Cutting Up Men. As part of her journey to find her path in life, Valerie Solanas wrote the Scum Manifesto, which talked about overturning capitalism and getting rid of everything. Especially men. A lot of people looked at it as a form of satire or a parody about patriarchy, but she claimed she was dead serious about everything she was writing. Looking at the dates in my notes, it looks like she started working on the Scum Manifesto while at Berkeley in the early 60s and then kept working on it until about 1967. She had initially self-published it and sold copies to women for a dollar, but for men it was $2.50, which is really on theme with the title and messaging of the manifesto itself. In August 1967, Solanas met a man named Maurice Girodius, who was the founder of Olympia Press. Thinking that it might be a great opportunity to get her work out into the world, she signed over her Scum manifesto to him for publication. Even though he paid her $500 for the rights to the manifesto, it was described as a really informal contract, almost like a handshake deal. When she signed that contract, her paranoia and mental health started to worsen a little bit because she had misinterpreted the document and thought that she had just signed away the rights to all of her future writings as well. You know, I kind of get it. Both formal contracts and handshake deals can be really stressful and scary if you have a lot on the line. I don't think it matters if you have an official contract that has tons of caveats and legal verbiage or a handshake deal where caveats aren't addressed. In one scenario, it's a lot of binding legal stuff. On the other hand, you have a lot of room for a lot of loopholes. I could see her walking away from that moment and just left wondering if she had all the information and if she truly knew what she just got herself into. Contracts and handshake deals can be very nerve-wracking when there's a lot on the line, especially for Solanas, where she had signed over something that she had spent years of her life working on. I'm not a licensed psychologist by any means, but looking at how she's been living her life in New York up until that point, she's barely scraping by, and she's doing it by begging, living in a hotel, giving up literally her own body just so she can get by. That leads me to think that she didn't have much of anything to her name. It might be kind of weird to talk about on an art podcast, but I think there's a human side to any art form and a creative's connection with their work. If we think about the effects of sex work on anyone, let alone an already unstable mental state, she's already given up so much of her body, so to sign away her work that she had spent so much time on, it's like giving up something incredibly personal. And I would argue that some creatives, who care about their work more than themselves, signing away their rights to something very personal, especially coming away from that deal with an unclear understanding of what the deal actually is, that can be very difficult and terrifying. With this story, looking from that perspective, it really helps get a fuller picture to kind of see where Valerie Solanas' mental state was and how that brought about the way everything after that went down. I think after all that really heavy talk for a minute, this is a good spot to take a quick break. And then when we come back, I promise we'll get back into the story and not into more deep psychological analysis of Valerie Solanas. Welcome back, everyone. Before the break, we talked about Andy Warhol, some of his life story, and his work. We also talked about a woman named Valerie Solanas and some of her life story up until 1967. It was at this time that Valerie Solanas met Andy Warhol. Warhol was standing outside of his studio called The Factory, and I guess Solanas kind of knew who he was because she approached him and she probably saw an opportunity. She asked him to produce a play she had written called Up Your Ass, which was about a young female prostitute who ends up murdering a man. Because Warhol was so famous and so recognizable, it kind of made sense for her to ask. Valerie Solanas didn't have much to her name. She was living in a hotel and just trying to get her work out there. Even though she had a little bit of success in 1966 with an autobiographical short story that was published in Cavalier magazine, she still hadn't seen success in getting her play into production. With Andy Warhol being who he was, if you had his endorsement, it could be life-changing and career-catapulting. With hope in her heart, Solanas gave Warhol one of her only copies of the play, and he promised to read the manuscript. There's a little bit of discrepancy between the dozen or so sources that I was looking at for this episode on what actually happened next. Some sources say that Warhol discarded the manuscript and laughed at how explicit it was. Some say that he simply misplaced it. Maybe it was a combination of both. Either way, Solanas continued to follow up with Warhol about the play, but I guess he eventually started feeling bad about the situation because he hired her to play a part in his experimental film called I, a Man, which is kind of ironic if you think about it. Well, as time went on, Valerie Solanas was becoming more and more paranoid. We've already talked about her feelings of paranoia when signing away her Scum manifesto for publication. But now she had given away one of the only physical copies of her play. So she kept trying to follow up with Warhol, but as he became more flippant about it and kept pushing it off and being really noncommittal, the more Solanas' paranoia heightened. It sounded like the film role was the first of a couple attempts Warhol made at using a job to bypass the issue or to compensate for the guilt he felt about misplacing the manuscript, because he eventually offered Solanas a job as a typist at the factory. To him, it probably seemed like a good fit. Even if he wasn't a fan of the content of her play script, it was at least well-typed. Unfortunately, she didn't really fit in with the crowd at the factory. A lot of the women that worked there were very feminine, and she felt just out of place as a lesbian woman with a more androgynous nature. The job just wasn't for her, so she declined it. Eventually, she became tired of the perceived amount of control that Warhol had on her life. Solanas had perceived the job offer as an indication that Warhol was trying to steal her play, and she was also worried that Warhol and Georgius, the man who had offered to publish her Scum manifesto, were conspiring against her, possibly to steal her work for themselves. Valerie Solanas decided that it was time to take matters into her own hands to decide her own fate and stop letting men control what little self-determination she had left. So she hatched a plan. On May 31st, 1968, Valerie Solanas went to a writer named Paul Krasner and asked him to borrow $50. At the time, he didn't know why she needed it. He probably only knew what she used as an excuse to borrow it. 3 days later, on the morning of June 3rd, 1968, Solanas went to the actor's studio on West 44th Street. Actress Sylvia Miles had a statement where she recalled seeing Solanas at the studio looking for theater director Lee Strasberg, asking to leave a copy of her play with him. Sylvia Miles stated that Solanas looked a bit tussled, like her appearance was the last thing on her mind. Miles told Solanas that Strasberg wouldn't be in until the afternoon. She accepted the script and then shut the door because she knew Solanas was trouble. What kind of trouble was something she wasn't sure about, but it was a gut feeling that was probably right. Solanas then went to the office of Maurice Georgius, the guy who offered to publish the Scum Manifesto. When she asked for him, his secretary said he wasn't there, but allegedly that didn't stop Solanas from telling the secretary that she was planning to kill Georgius. Luckily, she left without further incident and went to Andy Warhol's Union Square studio. She ran into a producer named Margot Feeden. Solanas talked to Feeden for almost 4 hours, trying to convince him to produce the play and discussing her vision for a world without men. Throughout this time, Feeden repeatedly refused to produce this play. Solanas, I guess, grew impatient and then pulled out a .32-caliber pistol and pointed it at him. When Feeden yet again refused to commit to producing the play, she threatened him at gunpoint, saying, "You will produce the play because I'll shoot Andy Warhol and that will make me famous and the play famous, and then you'll produce it." So she knew that any assassination attempt of Andy Warhol was nothing more than a publicity stunt. What's crazy is that even though Feeden reported the incident to the authorities, no one took Solanas seriously and they completely dismissed the entire thing. Maybe they shouldn't have, though, and maybe that actress from Solanas' first stop was right, because later that same day, Solanas waited outside of the factory waiting for Andy Warhol to arrive. Film director Paul Morrissey tried to get her to leave by telling her that Warhol wasn't coming in that day. But she waited and rode up and down the elevators until Warhol finally walked in. Solanas and Warhol took the elevator up to his office, where a group of people were already waiting for him. Morrissey, the same guy who tried to shoo her off earlier, threatened to physically assault her to try to get her to leave. But Solanas stood her ground. Morrissey gave up and left for the bathroom. When the phone rang and Warhol turned to answer it, Solanas reached for something. She pulled out the .32-caliber pistol and opened fire. She shot at Warhol, missing him with the first two shots. As he fell to the ground, scared for his life, he smashed into a desk and hit his head. Solanas came up to him and pressed the pistol into his side, just underneath his armpit. At point-blank range, the third bullet found its target and just ripped through him, hitting many of his major organs. In all the fast-paced insanity and chaos, Solanas also fired a bullet that grazed an art critic named Mario Amaya. Luckily, his injuries were minor and he was released from the hospital later that day. She was going to continue her rampage, but her gun jammed and she had to find a way out. Solanas had also aimed at Warhol's business manager, Fred Hughes, who pleaded for his life. As he begged not to be shot, the elevator doors abruptly opened. She got into the elevator and took it to the ground floor, fleeing the scene of the brutal assault. As for Andy Warhol, it took nearly 20 minutes for the ambulance to arrive after the first shots were fired in the office. Keep in mind, this event happened just 1 month before New York City first implemented its 911 calling system. The doctors massaged his heart to keep blood circulation flowing, and he was quickly rushed to the hospital. He was injured so badly that it wasn't clear if he would make it, and he was pronounced clinically dead for a whole 2 minutes. In an attempt to save his life, if there was any chance at all, Warhol underwent a 5-hour surgery to repair the damage to his ruptured stomach, liver, spleen, and lungs. I'm amazed with that kind of damage, he didn't bleed out on the spot in that office. This whole terrible series of events just sounds like something out of a really intense episode of a TV medical drama. Just 3 hours after the brutal attack, considering her work to be completed, Solana surrendered herself to the New York Police Department near Times Square. She told an officer that her reasoning for the whole attack was because Warhol had too much control in her life. The next morning, the New York Daily News ran the front page headline, "Actress Shoots Andy Warhol." Solana demanded a retraction of the statement. Why? Because she wasn't an actress. The Daily News changed the headline in its later edition and added a quote from Solana stating, "I'm a writer, not an actress." Despite all that happened, Andy Warhol surprisingly didn't press any charges against her. But that didn't mean she wouldn't just get away with attempted murder. At her arraignment in Manhattan Criminal Court, Solanas maintained that she was right in doing what she did. She felt that it was her moral obligation to shoot Warhol because she erroneously thought that he owned all of the rights to her artistic output. The famous quote from Solanas about this is, "I consider that a moral act. And I consider it immoral that I missed. I should have done target practice." The judge had her admitted to Bellevue Hospital for psychiatric observation. After a cursory evaluation, Solanas was declared mentally unstable and was transferred to a hospital prison ward. Just 10 days after the shooting, Solanas appeared in front of the New York Supreme Court. On June 28, 1968, Solanas was indicted on charges of attempted murder, assault, and illegal possession of a firearm. In August of 1968, she was declared incompetent and sent to a state hospital for the criminally insane. Ironically, that same month of August 1968, Olympia Press published the Scum Manifesto with essays by Georgius and Krasner. What's even more ironic is that her attempted assassination of Warhol successfully gave Solanas her 15 minutes of fame and propelled her into the public spotlight with a flurry of commentary and opinions in the media. In January 1969, Solanas underwent psychiatric evaluation and was diagnosed with chronic paranoid schizophrenia. A year after the shooting, she was deemed fit to stand trial. She represented herself without an attorney and pleaded guilty to reckless assault with intent to harm. Solanas was sentenced to 3 years in prison with 1 year of time already served. She tried to write to Warhol while in prison, but naturally and understandably, he never answered her letters. Solanas was released from the New York State Prison for Women in 1971, but her freedom was very short-lived. She was homeless in New York City and sadly had several breakdowns and mental health episodes. Stalking Warhol and others over the telephone quickly led to her arrest again in November of 1971. She was in and out of prison and institutionalized several times before finally moving out of New York. She lived in Arizona and then San Francisco, where she began writing again, publishing what she believed to be the purest form of the Scum Manifesto. Eventually, though, Solanas just drifted into obscurity. Solanas passed away in 1988 at the age of 52. According to the New York Times, she had been dead for 5 days before her body was discovered in her San Francisco hotel room by the owner who was looking to collect her delinquent rental payments. Her official cause of death was pneumonia. It wasn't until 1999 when that original play was rediscovered. The best part of this story? The exact same copy Warhol had lost was found in a trunk of lighting equipment owned by his friend and Silver Factory decorator, Billy Name. It would be the start of a whole new century in the year of 2000 when the play was finally produced and saw its first performance in San Francisco. What an absolutely tragic yet somewhat appropriate end to the story of Valerie Solanas. But we can't forget about Andy Warhol. After all, his name is in the title of the episode. Following the attack, Andy Warhol spent 2 months recovering in the hospital during the late summer of 1968. He grew to fear and absolutely hate hospitals. And I think that's a pretty acceptable reaction after everything that he went through. What's really unfortunate about all of this is that he had to wear a surgical corset to help him with abdomen stabilization for the rest of his life, and he continued to experience health problems. There were follow-up surgeries, infections, just all kinds of complications that would really degrade the quality of life for anyone. But I think one of the most profound impacts of his shooting was how it impacted his art. As he said, "I stopped being creative when I was shot." Even though he continued to create works throughout the 70s, it was a much quieter decade for him as he became a lot more guarded and abandoned a lot of his filmmaking and more controversial art. Really, he was just focusing more on business. That was actually one of his biggest criticisms in the 70s and 80s, was that he had become, quote-unquote, a business artist and had lost that thing that had made him so revolutionary in the 60s. Looking at specific Warhol works from the 80s, you can really see how his whole mindset shifted, and recurring themes of death and violence and human mortality were more present in the pieces he created. His 1981 series of gun prints was created as commentary on gun violence, but also his own personal experience with it. The gun depicted is eerily similar to the gun that Solanas used to shoot him. And then, if we look back a little further, there was another portfolio of works in 1976 showing skulls. And while they're created using the bright colors that we can generally associate with Warhol's works, the contrast between the soup cans of the 60s and these skulls is really stark and just shows how he was wrestling with his own mortality and fears of death in hospitals. And with that fear of hospitals and illness, Warhol tried a lot of different alternative medicines and treatments. For a while, he was dosing on speed almost every day. He took a lot of Valium, uppers, downers. I don't think that helped his body physically or his fear that Solanas would come after him again. At the same time, his fear of hospitals created this hesitance that caused him to delay appointments and procedures, which may have eventually led to his death. One of the infections that he faced was an infected gallbladder. This condition became so bad that, despite his fear of hospitals, he went under the knife in February 1987 for gallbladder surgery. Although some people might call it a routine operation, it turned out to be a really tricky surgery and wasn't routine at all. Somewhere around 4 in the morning, his heart stopped. They did CPR to try to revive him, but in the end, his heart just gave out. Andy Warhol was officially pronounced dead, for real this time, on February 22nd, 1987. Wow, guys, I am so sorry. This story turned out to be a whole lot darker and way more tragic than I anticipated. I'll admit, last week when I first read that there was an attempted assassination on Andy Warhol's life, it was a really quick choice to do it as this week's episode, and I started researching even before last week's episode dropped. But I wasn't familiar with any of the specific details before digging into that research, and I had no clue that it was this dark. I almost considered changing my mind, but in a way, I think that not talking about something just because it's dark is doing a disservice to the people who lived it. So hopefully I did the story justice, and I hope you found this week's story at least a little bit interesting. Don't forget to leave a 5-star review if you're enjoying this show. You can leave a comment too, or just the stars. And if you have any questions or want to reach out to me about topics for the show or something you really want to hear me talk about, please feel free to email me at outrageous.artpod@gmail.com. I'll be back next Thursday with a story that's not nearly as dark. I'm thinking maybe something a little more fun, even though I'm not quite sure what that is yet, but I'll come up with something and I'll catch you then. Until then, stay outrageous. Series music created by Arenson. Music and transition sounds licensed from Motion Array. Artrageous is a proud partner of Stoveleg Media.
Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.